This is Sound Ideas. I'm Mike McCurdy. A gay married Catholic from the Springfield Diocese is reacting to restrictions his bishop has placed on gay parishioners.
It's not the job of the priest to judge the state of someone else's soul. No one can judge the state of someone else's soul.
Springfield church member John Fremmel ponders his future with the Catholic Church. Get a preview of the Illinois Shakespeare Festival opening night. Laura Kennedy has the story. We observe the centennial of a streetcar strike in Bloomington. Find out why this labor action is important. And John Norton talks with Sarah Shook. Her band, The Disarmers, are headed to Central Illinois. All of that, plus a GLT News update on the way. It's June 29th, 2017. This is Sound Ideas on GLT.
Support for the Sound Ideas podcast comes from listener contributions to GLT, with additional support from Country Financial Representative Justin M. Boyd. Information at justinmboyd.com. This is 89.1 GLT and WGLT.org.
This is Sound Ideas. I'm Mike McCurdy. The Catholic Bishop of Springfield recently issued guidelines stating people in same-sex marriages or relationships cannot receive communion, participate in parish ministries, or receive Catholic burial rites unless they repent their actions. Bishop Thomas Paprocki's statement sparked a national backlash among gay Catholics and their families. The bishop said people in same-sex marriages bring, quote, scandal on the faithful. It was also because he issued his pronouncement as the gay community was commemorating the first anniversary of the shootings at the Pulse Gay Nightclub in Orlando. The guidelines are directed at people like John Fremmel, who married his same-sex partner in 2014. Fremmel tells GLT's Judy Valente the bishop is out of step with other church leaders and a majority of Catholics.
I'm, I guess, what you would call a cradle Catholic. I was born and raised in the Catholic Church. Baptized at St. Agnes Parish here in Springfield. I went to St. Agnes Grade School, Sacred Heart Griffin High School. The church has always been an integral part of my upbringing and particularly my education.
As you realized that you were gay, did you have any hesitation of remaining in the Catholic Church, which has had a longstanding teaching that although being homosexual is not wrong, engaging in homosexual activity is a sin?
I probably first knew I was gay when I was, I would guess, in fifth grade, I think are my earliest memories of when I started to experience same-sex attraction. For the longest time, I tried to ignore who I was and what I was experiencing, and when it became evident to me that I could no longer ignore that, I went through a pretty dark period in my life where I tried to change that, where I dated girls in high school. I went to church more often than probably most Catholic kids do. At one point, I was inside a church every single day praying that God would change me, and eventually it just became evident that that wasn't going to happen either. I came out my senior year of high school. Luckily, the community was fantastically supportive. My teachers stuck up for me.
And this is a Catholic high school, I might add.
This is a Catholic high school, yes. One of the sisters who worked in campus ministry hugged me and told me that I was perfect just the way I was, which, I mean, at that point in time, that's exactly what I needed to hear. Yeah, so I realize, though, that that's not the experience of many kids in Catholic schools. So my experience in that sense, I think, is somewhat atypical, but I think was really foundational in my faith life as an adult.
Are you currently a member of a parish in the Springfield Diocese?
Yeah, I go to St. Joseph.
Are you active in that parish?
Yeah, we've been going there for a couple years. We are also licensed foster parents in Illinois, and our first placement was an infant who we took home from the hospital. We had her for 10 months, and we took her to Mass with us every Sunday. And so even if we weren't always introducing ourselves as the gay couple, you know, people still saw us. We didn't make any effort to hide who we were. I mean, here are two men with a baby. I mean, it was quite obvious to everyone in the parish who we were, and the atmosphere from every single person was very welcoming, very affirming. People made a point to let us know that our family was welcome there as we were.
Even the pastor and the priests at the parish.
Yeah, I mean, and I have to be careful because I don't want to get anybody in trouble in the diocese. You know, the bishop, I think, has a very authoritarian way of ruling his domain. And so I want to be careful. But I will say that, yes, our pastor was very welcoming, very kind to us from the very beginning, made it known that, again, we were welcome in the parish as we were.
The bishop of Springfield, Thomas Papraki, mm-hmm. has issued what he called a policy decree on same-sex marriage. And he said that same-sex couples, people who are in gay relationships, are not to mm-hmm. serve in ministries, they are not to receive communion, and they mm-hmm. cannot be buried from the Catholic Church. What was your reaction to that?
I was very disappointed and very hurt. On one hand, what is in this decree is not really anything new. This has been the official teaching and practice of the church now for quite some time, obviously. But on the other hand, we have a pope and we have other bishops who have made it clear that they see the church going in a different direction. Archbishop Supich in Chicago, for example, Blaise Supich, he recently affirmed that LGBT couples in same-sex marriage can receive communion in the Archdiocese of Chicago because, according to Supich, presenting yourself for communion is a matter of conscience of the individual person who presents themselves for communion. It's not the job of the priest to judge the state of someone else's soul. No one can judge the state of someone else's soul. And if you feel that you are in a good place and your conscience tells you it's okay, then go for it. Pope Francis has said something similar. He welcomed a Lutheran woman to communion, for example, not that long ago. And we have bishops like Joseph Tobin.
Newark Diocese.
Yeah, he just welcomed a group of LGBT pilgrims to his cathedral, and he introduced himself as Joseph, your brother. And so we have other bishops too, Robert McElroy in San Diego, who are making it clear that they see the church going in a different direction, that the church is not to be exclusive. The church is a field hospital, as Pope Francis has said, and the Eucharist, communion, is, again, another Pope Francis quote, it's not a prize for the perfect, but it's medicine for the sick. You know, we don't have to be necessarily in this perfect state of existence in order to receive communion, because nobody is. Everybody is sinning all the time. And what makes one sin greater than another sin? And I'm not implying that being married in a same-sex relationship is a sin in this case.
You're listening to Sound Ideas. I'm Judy Valente. I'm talking with John Fremmel, who is a parishioner in the Diocese of Springfield. We're talking about the Springfield Bishop's new pronouncement on same-sex marriage policies there. So I take it that you have no plans not to receive communion when you go to Mass on Sunday. You are going to continue going to Mass, the Catholic Mass on Sunday.
At least at this point, last Sunday, we were not denied communion, and I hope that this coming Sunday will be the same. If we're in a situation in which that's a possibility, then we'll have to reevaluate, obviously, because I don't want to put myself or my husband or anyone in my family in a situation in which they no longer feel comfortable or safe, or in which their spirituality or their relationship with God could potentially be in jeopardy, I guess.
Many people have commented on the refusal to give funeral rites, Catholic burial rites, to gay men and women who are married mm-hmm. or in relationship. And many have said that might be just the most hurtful part of the pronouncement of Bishop Papraki. How would you feel if your spouse was denied mm-hmm. Catholic funeral rites? And how would your spouse feel if the same happened to you?
It's something I don't even want to think about because, you know, the funeral ritual, I guess, is really for the family. It's for the people who are grieving the loss of someone. This really is a slap in the face of the survivors, of the people who have already experienced a great trauma, and this just magnifies that trauma. I hope that when that time comes, that we can ensure somehow that we would be able to make arrangements in advance that would be satisfactory to everyone involved.
You mentioned that you married your spouse in 2014, obviously not in the Catholic Church.
Right.
Was that hard not to have the ceremony in the church of your faith?
Well, you know, there is a movement who some in the Catholic Church might call heretical or schismatic. I don't think so, but it's called the Roman Catholic Women Priests Movement. It's a movement where women who are called to the priesthood can be ordained in a Catholic ceremony, and they maintain the line of apostolic succession, which is so important to the Catholic priesthood. And I was able to find a Roman Catholic woman priest who said Mass for us, and so we had a wedding Mass. It was not in a Catholic church, but it was in a United Church of Christ congregation that I had discovered while I was in college. We had, like I said, a Catholic Mass, and so that was very important to me, and I was very happy to be able to do that.
Bishop Papraki issued a further clarification of his pronouncement on same-sex marriage policies, and he said that, in his defense, that the Catholic Church not only has the authority, but also the obligation to disseminate its teachings and to ask people to abide by its teachings. Would you agree with that?
Well, I think we have to make a very clear distinction here between the church and the hierarchy. The hierarchy is certainly a part of the church, but it is not the entire church. And the bishops, in particular Bishop Papraki, does not own the church. In reality, the church is the people of God. And the people of God, the people in the pews who go to Mass, reject discrimination against LGBT people, and especially against LGBT Catholics within the church. I just read, actually, on Monday, a new Pew study that said 67%, that's two-thirds of Catholics, are in support of same-sex marriage. And the only category that's higher than Catholics in support of same-sex marriage are non-affiliated, non-religious people who don't identify with any religion. So other than that group, Catholics support marriage equality in a higher number than any other category of individuals in the United States. So that tells you something right there. You know, several hundred years ago, before this era of, I would say, neoconservative bishops, a teaching had to be affirmed by the hierarchy, by theologians, and by the people, by the laity. And the current teaching on sexuality, and in particular LGBT issues, it's certainly affirmed by many within the hierarchy. It's not affirmed by theologians. It's not affirmed or accepted by the laity. And so I think that's an important key point here that you have to keep in mind.
John Fremmel is a parishioner in the Diocese of Springfield. John, thank you for talking about the bishop's new pronouncement on same-sex marriage policies.
Thank you very much for having me.
I'm Judy Valente.
In response to questions posed by GLT News, Springfield Bishop Thomas Papraki enlarged on his position. He said his decree is not a condemnation of people who are gay and lesbian. He said, quote, "My decree does not focus on LGBT people, but on so-called same-sex marriage, which is a public legal status." He goes on to say, "No one is denied the sacraments or Christian burial for simply having a homosexual orientation. Even someone who has entered into a same-sex marriage can receive the sacraments and be given ecclesiastical funeral rites if they repent and renounce their marriage." End quote. You're listening to Sound Ideas.
Support for GLT's Sound Ideas comes from Justin M. Boyd, Country Financial Representative, building relationships while supporting and serving the community. Justin offers life insurance options designed to protect your family and leave a lasting legacy. Information at justinmboyd.com. This is 89.1 GLT and WGLT.org.
¶¶ It's Sound Ideas. I'm Mike McCurdy. Coming up next week is a centennial of the streetcar strike in Bloomington Normal. It's the date in 1917 when Mother Jones visited the Twin Cities in solidarity with the strikers and when the governor ordered in troops to camp on the courthouse lawn to restore order. Labor historian Mike Matika is giving a walking tour of the places important to the strike on the anniversary next week, and he joined GLT's Charlie Schlenker to talk about the history involved. Matika says the visit of the national labor figure and the wild and woolly night following her speech was incredibly important.
Without Mother Jones, that strike would have been lost. And her appearance in Bloomington on the night of July 5th, 1917, after these workers had been out since May, they were in a difficult situation. You know, they had formed a union before. They had lost it. They lost their union when the company refused to negotiate, and they had a six-month strike in 1904. And unless this incredible woman had not come to town, I think they would have faded away and not been able to carry on, because all of them had been replaced. There was a strict court injunction limiting their public activity, so the deck was pretty well stacked against that group of workers.
And what shifted following that?
A couple things. Number one, he basically had a street riot after she came, which put the issue front and center in the community. And that really pressured the mayor and the civic authorities at the time. Look, we got to settle this. And Snyder, the superintendent of the streetcar company, was adamant he was not going to do it. And they basically reached over his head to upper management and said, "We need to settle this." And I think the other key was the railroad workers. The largest employer in Bloomington at the time was Chicago and Alton, the shops on the west side. And the day after Mother Jones was here with the National Guard and camped around the courthouse square, these guys laid down their tools and marched on City Hall. And basically, the implicit message was, you know, we're going to shut the town down if this is not settled. And, you know, she was the spur of all that happening. She was the spark plug that brought that all about.
Put in context for today's listeners who may not know all that much about her, how big a figure she was in the labor movement in that era.
Yeah, in the early 20th century, Mother Jones had been christened the most dangerous woman in America. And this was a woman who often made the statement that, "I don't have an address. My address is my shoes, and my shoes go where there's trouble." She was literally all over the country in strikes and job actions and pushing for child labor legislation and working on safety issues, and was a beloved figure. People knew her. She would have been here before on speaking tours. She was somebody whose all you had to see was Mother Jones in a headline, and people knew who was being spoken about. And imagine in a time period before women can vote, here's this woman in her 70s and 80s trampling around the countryside, organizing workers, speaking up in often very profane language, and mobilizing people and challenging the economic system and trying to reinforce to people that you have rights and you only get those rights when you stand up for those rights.
What were the economic conditions for the streetcar workers?
At this time, these workers were making about $2.25 a day. They worked a 9.5-hour day, 6 days a week. They had managed to get Sundays off because when the streetcar system started and until the early 20th century, they worked every day. They had no days off. And originally, they worked 14 to 15 hours a day. So it was steady work, which was good at that time period. But at the same time, it was a very, very long day. The pay was not that good.
What is the buying power of a $2.25 a day?
You know, think, again, not somebody who's an expert on prices of the early 20th century, but think, you know, was a loaf of bread 10 cents, 25 cents? You know, was rent maybe $50 to $80 a month? So you start putting that together, and how do you stretch $2.25 a day to put all of that together? Not to mention clothing and uniforms for your work and all of those things that would go with it.
It begs the question, if their working day was 9 to 9.5 hours and a 6 day week, and it had earlier been 14 hours a day for 7 days a week, what happened to give them the initial improved conditions?
I think a couple things. I've got to remember, World War I had started, and there were no wage and price controls during World War I, so there was inflation, you know, and that was having an impact. And I think they saw an opportunity with labor shortage there. And at the same time, the same system, this was not just a Bloomington company. This was the what became Illinois Power Company. You know, they owned the Illinois Traction, the Interurban Railroad. They owned the trolley systems in Champaign, Danville, Galesburg, Alton, Peoria, so Decatur. And they were giving workers in other places a raise. And Peoria workers in particular had come over to Bloomington and talked to the workers here because Peoria workers were making higher wages and they were getting better raises. And so I think that was part of the incentive, too. When they first met, they were offered 20 cents a day in a wage increase, which was less than others were getting. But at the same time, I think they saw a need to have a voice. So they said, we don't just want a wage increase. We want an organization to stand up for us.
And what did they secure after they won this?
After they won, they got 35 cents a day, and their workday was reduced from 9.5 hours to 9 hours. But most significantly, the company recognized what was at that time the Amalgamated Association of Street and Electric Railway Employees, Local Number 752, which is today's Amalgamated Transit Union, Local 752, which represents our bus drivers in town. So these folks were able to get an organization to be their voice. And that really became the critical issue here.
This is Sound Ideas. I'm Charlie Schlenker. We're talking with labor historian Mike Matika, who's also written a book called Fiery Struggle, Illinois Firefighters Build a Union. How significant was this particular strike compared to other job actions around the state?
It actually, the streetcar workers in Springfield, employees in the same system, followed Bloomington's lead. They had a strike that same summer after Bloomington won this. So it kind of set off a cascade of activities. And actually, it's almost amusing when you go back and read the newspaper's accounts of that strike. There was, again, another outburst of street activity and demonstration around Labor Day. And they blamed it on people coming up to Bloomington for the Labor Day parade and getting Bloomington liquor and coming back down to Springfield that night.
Was Springfield dry or something?
I think Bloomington was dry. So I'm curious where this liquor came from.
Yes, exactly.
Bloomington was dry before Prohibition.
Before Prohibition.
I think what's fascinating to me is the labor community at the time period that stuck together. So here's a relatively small group of workers, 90 to 100 people that are employed by this system. But 1,300 people in the railroad shops lay down their tools and march on downtown, potentially putting their own jobs at risk and saying, we want this settled. And that sense of solidarity and standing up for each other, an injury to one is an injury to all, was very much an active part of the labor culture and hopefully still is. I think the normal firefighter strike in 1978, you know, when you had 25, 26 people in the normal fire department, but it became not only a local but a state and a national issue, and people mobilized for that small group. So that sense of solidarity, I think, was incredibly strong in the community, and this is just really a testament that people saw that what impacted one group of workers could potentially impact everyone.
How quickly did they settle after Mother Jones' appearance and the National Guard's encampment and so forth?
Actually, that all happened by the following Monday afternoon, a four-hour negotiating session in the mayor's office, and it was settled. So once the Mother Jones was here, the troops came, everything quieted down very quickly with the troops in town. And then from that point on, once the mayor agreed with the railroad shop workers that he would set up some mediation, people were satisfied, and they allowed that process to play itself out. And it was just a matter of days at that point.
You mentioned that the union formed by the streetcar workers became the union for the Connect Transit workers. Is there a direct connection, or is there a gap between the time the streetcar company folded up shop and the bus system began?
It's been direct all the time. So when the Illinois Power sold the streetcar system to the before it was Connect Transit, it was a private company. American City Lines, when they sold it to them, they recognized the workers. And when Connect Transit came, they recognized the workers. So it's been a direct lineage. National City Lines, not American City Lines. But anyway, with the workers have always been recognized since 1917.
This is Sound Ideas. I'm Charlie Schlenker. We're talking with labor historian Mike Matika. Where did Mother Jones go after visiting Bloomington?
She was very active in the steel strike of 1919, which was a strike was crushed, but very significant attempt to organize industrial workers on a mass basis. In 1920-21, she was in the hills of West Virginia with, if you ever saw the movie Matewan, about the strike and actually military action almost with armed battles in the hills of West Virginia and southern West Virginia in 1920 and 21. She was in the middle of that. And then she kind of went into a retirement. She still circulated around the country more in a speaking tour kind of capacity. But by that time, she's in her mid to late 80s. And she eventually retires to a family home in Maryland, and that's where she dies in 1930. So this is kind of at her career really spans maybe 1895 through the early 1920s is kind of when she's very much a public figure.
Tell us about your walking tour.
Well, what we're going to do on the centennial evening on July 5th, and we'll repeat it again on July 7th at 6 p.m., start at Bloomington City Hall, which is right across the street from the Eagles Hall, where Mother Jones spoke at that time period, kind of give a sense of the conditions. We'll walk down to the old powerhouse, which still stands, and that's where a confrontation took place. And basically, the crowd or the mob demanded that the whole power plant be shut down, to shut down this electric streetcar system. And the mayor agreed with them. And then they marched on downtown Bloomington, broke the windows of the transit company office, and held a confrontation with the police, who were actually shooting their guns into the pavement to try to disperse the crowd. And so we'll be going to actual sites where a lot of this action took place on July 5th.
The 12-block walking tour presented by the McLean County Museum of History will be at 6 p.m. starting at Bloomington City Hall, July 5th and 7th. It's free, and Matika says there is no pre-registration. Labor historian Mike Matika spoke with GLT's Charlie Schlenker. It's Sound Ideas. I'm Mike McCurdy. The Illinois Shakespeare Festival is launching its 40th season with an imaginative and musical presentation of the Bard's comedy of love, laughter, and magical trickery in an enchanted forest. Laura Kennedy has more with the lead actors in A Midsummer Night's Dream.
Nissi Sturgis and Jordan Cawftry are well met by moonlight. On stage and off, the Illinois Shakespeare Festival actors share the stage in A Midsummer Night's Dream this season. And off stage, they're united in marriage and proud parents of 3-year-old Owen. Sturgis and Cawftry have lived with this tune-filled version of Shakespeare's beloved comedy for some time now. Well known as a musical adapter of Shakespeare, Cawftry was working at the Arkansas Shakespeare Festival with Robert Quinlan when the director invited him to make music in Midsummer. Now this unique staging has come to the Illinois Shakespeare Festival, with Quinlan again at the helm. Sturgis as Tatiana and Hippolyta, and Cawftry playing Puck, and playing the music he wrote specifically for this renowned romantic romp.
It's such a magical, kind of fantastic play, and it involves, you know, fairies and spells. So we talked about the idea of having the spells and the magic be music. That's where it started, and it kind of bloomed and blossomed from there.
It just really sets the scene for all the different worlds, because you have the court, you have the forest, you have the world of the fairies, you have all these different things that sort of merge together, and when you have this thread of music throughout, it unifies things, and it also helps get it more specific, and it creates a delight that the audience can follow a thread through. And in fact, one of the songs, if I can share this, that begins the show. It's called the I Love You Song, or an I Love You Song. I actually wrote for our son when he was first born. I would sing this to Owen, our son. And then Jordan adapted it and started intertwining the...
Adding all these other parts.
Yeah, all these parts and Shakespeare inside it. And now it's this beautiful round that's so joyful and begins the show in this just really buoyant and personal way.
Yeah. It sounds like an extraordinary collaboration between yourselves and Shakespeare.
I know.
Yes,
it is. Been one of our greatest friends. Truly, throughout our lives in this art and through this strange world of the theater that has been such a home and has brought us some of the best people with whom we could ever hope to share our time, Shakespeare has been this constant of perspective about humanity. There's no situation that can come up in the news or just day-to-day in relationships that you can't look back to and think, oh, people have been dealing with this through all time. And to have someone who's interested in exploring that with you, Shakespeare, through all of his plays, really goes in depth with the human psyche and the human heart and has this great sense of play. I mean, making up all these words and everyone immediately just, it's for all of us and we connect and feel like our relationship has been strengthened and supported by exploring his work.
For the music in A Midsummer Night's Dream, how would you guys classify it? Or does it defy classification?
I write other songs as well, and I've kind of started calling my genre of music folk-ish.
I like that.
I mean, the instruments that we use, the instruments that I play, I play Puck in the show, and the instruments that Puck plays are the ukulele and the guitar and the mandolin. So kind of folk-ish instruments, but with different, I don't know, different genre. It feels like different genres come along. I mean, it's set...
You borrow sounds from all over.
And we've kind of been working through, I mean, some of the early renditions of some songs had sort of almost like a gospel feel, and some of them have a rock.
And that
rock.
Was more for Arkansas, and we thought, okay, well, let's where are we now with this company, and what do we want to say at this point? So then you can adapt, basically. Yeah.
It's like a living play.
Yeah.
You're
exactly.
Making the changes as it moves around.
Right, and adding songs and taking some songs away. There are some songs that have kind of almost a rock and roll feel, and some that have sort of a jaunty like 30s or 40s feel. It is kind of all over the map, which is great.
Well, you've got your mandolin with you.
I do.
Can we hear something?
Well, yeah. I thought I'd play one of my favorite songs.
Mine too.
Nice.
What's it called?
It's called All Shall Be Well.
Okay.
On the ground, sleep sound, I'll apply to your eye, gentle lover, remedy. When thou wak'st, thou tak'st true delight in the sight of thy former lady's eye. Country proverb known that everyone should take their own, and thy waiting shall be shown. Jack shall have Jill, naught shall go ill, this man shall have his mare. Shall be well.
Oh, that is so beautiful.
Thank you.
So emotional, too.
Thanks.
That is gorgeous.
Yeah.
That must be a joy to sing in the show.
It is. It's a pleasure.
There are so many talented people in this company, and the musicians are, you know, they're so generous with their time and their ability, but they bring such heart to it. Everyone has their own unique experience to bring, and they're also game, and it's really beautiful right now to see people connect and share and open up and say, yes, I'm willing and I'm here and what can we do together? And it's been really healing in a lot of ways.
Yeah, and I think it's really special for this play too in particular. I mean, I usually write music just for myself. You know, I don't usually play with a band or other people, really. I haven't really had that opportunity. But for this, there are all kinds of voices and instruments and instrumentalists that come together to create the music in the show. I think it's really beautiful for this play in which so many things kind of seem to be going wrong. You know, it's really, things get really out of whack and out of balance in really fun and wonderful ways.
And it's Puck's fault.
And it was. Okay, all right. Yeah, it may be. It may be. but it's ultimately the community. It's the cast. It's the company. It's all of us kind of on this, you know, this ground level that come together and write this out of balance world in a really beautiful way. And we get to do that with music. We get to join our voices with music and with harmony.
When you have a place that's as beautiful and unique as Ewing Manor, to honor that place by bringing together artists that say we value beauty and we are willing to risk what we value and giving up time wherever we live and come to this place and build together and meet the people of Bloomington Normal and say it matters that you're here, it matters that this place is here. How can we celebrate what's special about where you are and where we all are together?
And there's something really great about it being an outdoor theater too, amid
divine.
This beautiful manor and the beautiful garden. That the theater is, I mean, it is contained, but it's this open air. The audience sees us up on stage. We see the audience. We interact with the audience. We come in and out of the audience. You know, we're all in it together. There's no real divide. The fourth wall that we call it in the acting world, where you ignore the audience, really gets torn down in this play in really fun and exciting ways. So,
and with it being an outdoor theater, you can talk about the sun and the sky or the clouds, and you all look up together and see it. And it's so rare that we take the time to do that.
Oh,
but
yeah.
Shakespeare asks us to do that.
Right. And in Midsummer Night's Dream especially, so much of it takes place in the forest, out in the forest, in the wild. And we've got the forest in the wild, right
You've
with
us.
You've
got the crickets and all that stuff going on that, you know, that it would be there.
That would be there, right. It's not a distraction. It's immersive. It's part of the world. I mean, there's the one line in the beginning song, the sweet breeze gives the trees a gentle kiss. But I sing that line, the sweet breeze gives the trees a gentle kiss, and you hear the wind blowing through the trees as you're singing it. It's so cool.
Yeah. Well, speaking of gentle kisses.
Oh.
Where are we going with this?
Well, it's something that you two have shared. You're a married couple.
Mm-hmm. Oh, yes.
You've been together for a number of years now. What is that like for you? What are the biggest challenges and the biggest joys of being an actor pair?
I immediately start crying when you ask me this question. To have someone love you over time and through any struggle is incredibly profound and humbling. When you have someone do that in this world of theater, which is so much about putting yourself in someone else's shoes, and you have your partner see you do that and see you grow by telling these stories and see you struggle as you know, to learn anything takes time. But to have your partner watch you learn in front of other people, telling their stories and sharing your own rarefication, it's very intense, but it's also vulnerable in a way that I think makes us, we celebrate what's truly real about the other.
Yeah. Absolutely.
Yeah.
It's a very unique life, the life of an actor, particularly actors who travel very often. But acting generally, I mean, there's an ebb and flow as opportunities come and opportunities go, which is thrilling and frightening. Mm-hmm. And it's so wonderful to have a partner who is in that trench with you.
Because it's really hard.
But and also on that mountaintop with you, you know, to celebrate with you. And to understand both the high and the low in a way that is as unique as the lifestyle itself.
And to be given the opportunity by this theater and from our friend Robert Quinlan, who is the director of the piece, who has seen us over time. He met us before we were married and saw each of us as our own talents. It's rare that a place gives you the opportunity to work together at all, so we feel incredibly fortunate. But to have someone who is as skilled as Robert Quinlan and his ability to trust us and trust our relationship to hopefully enhance the process instead of complicate it. You know, because yes. keeping the personal and professional in balance, that's hard for anybody in their lives.
Yeah.
But to have a friend see you and trust you and say, you're welcome here, and I know what this can bring to this process.
Yeah.
Well, would it be at all possible? Could we go out with another song?
I'll see if I can jump in there.
How now, spirit? Whither wander you?
Over hill, over dale, through bush, through briar, over park, over pale, through flood, through fire.
Missy Sturgis and Jordan Coftry and Mary Wanderer on Sound Ideas. They spoke with GLT's Laura Kennedy. Hear more from Sturgis and Coftry of the Illinois Shakespeare Festival in bonus audio at our website, WGLT.org. They talk about their lives off and off stage, on and off stage, plus how theater is in their son's DNA. A Midsummer Night's Dream opens tomorrow evening at Ewing Theater. This is Sound Ideas.
Rude and knavish sprite that some call Robin a sweet, sweet puck.
You do. Support for GLT comes from Jack Baytall Real Estate Group at Keller Williams. Jack and his team are committed to helping Bloomington Normal continue to thrive by giving back to GLT and other local nonprofits. Current listings at jacksguarantee.com. This is 89.1 GLT and WGLT.org.
It's Sound Ideas. Sarah Shook once described herself as a vegan, bisexual, atheist, civil rights activist, female in a country band in the South. That band, known as the Disarmers, just released a new album titled Sidelong. GLT's John Norton caught up with Shook to talk about her self-description and about the retro nature of the new album that's receiving rave reviews.
Home Fires Burning. It's the opening track to the stunning new album by Sarah Shook and the Disarmers. And Sarah Shook on the phone from her home in North Carolina. Thanks for your time, Sarah. I'm glad you're on with us.
Absolutely. Thanks for having me.
As you can tell, I love this album. It's so refreshing to hear what I call honky tonk updated. And I'm sure you get asked this all the time, but let me just ask it anyway. Where does this love of older country music come from? You're someone in your early 30s.
Yeah. Well, I had a very strange upbringing as far as music goes, and was certainly not exposed to a lot of the pop music that was popular with people in my age group then and now. And so I kind of found old school traditional country quite a few years ago through an ex-boyfriend who had a really good record collection. All the greats, Juana Jackson, Merle Haggard, Hank Sr., and I just kind of fell in love with it.
Would you say Juana Jackson is sort of a mentor, an idol of yours?
She's definitely a personal hero.
I mean, there's some similarities in the way even vocally you phrase what you're doing compared to what Wanda, well, she's still doing, actually.
Yeah, she's still doing. I had the pleasure of seeing her, I think, in a couple years back at the local 506 in Chapel Hill, and I believe she was about 77 at the time. And I mean, her performance was so powerful and just so real. I mean, the energy in the room was incredible.
Keep the Home Fires Burning is what I started with here. And the next song on the album is called The Nail. It's two songs about similar things. The Home Fires Burning, your guy's not there. The Nail is someone you're trying to work out a relationship with. There's a lot of pain in these songs. There's a lot of pain on the entire album. Was this a difficult album for you to write, or was it cathartic for you to write this album?
It was very cathartic. I think that's kind of why I started writing songs in the first place. I needed some kind of creative outlet, and my folks happened to have a very out-of-tune old upright piano in the hallway, and it just started coming about that was my means of exercising my demons.
Why don't you go ahead and grab your shovel, finish that beer and grab another, get your ass outside and dig a hole, a hole big enough for little
the Nail, Sarah Shook, and the Disarmers. Well, I talked about how you and Wanda Jackson share a similarity in how you're phrasing, but I also love how your voice occasionally, it warbles, it sneers, it laughs, and, you know, there's a lot of other emotions that really cut through. It's like you're on stage a little bit. Do you have a little bit of theater in your background? Do you have an acting background?
I don't have an acting background. I took a physical theater at an internship, actually, with Push Physical Theater out of Rochester, New York, for a while. But that didn't really involve any speaking roles, which was kind of a nice change. But once I found music and you know, started kind of playing my first handful of shows, I realized that was definitely the art form that suited me best.
Yeah. You're putting this, you're consciously putting it in, or does it just happen?
No, it's very, you know, when you take songs, a lot of the songwriting that's coming out of Nashville that, you know, you've got four or five people sitting in kind of a think tank sort of situation, I think it kind of takes away some of the personal experience and certainly like the pain that you were talking about earlier. And so, you know, these songs are songs that I've written from personal experience, and, you know, I've had to live the hard stuff to get the good songs, you know what I mean? I think that a lot of the emotion that you hear coming through vocally is just certainly tied into that. You know, they're very personal, very, very real songs to me.
No Name is another song on the album that I think highlights a number of the ways you're emoting that we just talked about. I want to play just a little bit of that song here.
You'll never find my name, though you may look, for my name is only found in the devil's book. I leave a wake of death behind me, 1,000 miles wide, 1,000 rivers of blood and tears, a dying cry.
No Name is the song. It's Sarah Shook and the Disarmers. You're listening to GLT Sound Ideas. Sarah, you've got a classic quote from, I think, an interview you must have done last year, and I want to read it and then unpack it a little bit. I'm a vegan, bisexual, atheist, civil rights activist, female in a country band in the South.
Yep.
It's a great quote. There's a lot to unpack, but most of those attributes haven't traditionally been associated with country music. Have you been embraced or not by country?
I think so. I certainly haven't received any negative backlash from being honest about who I am and what's important to me. But I think that honesty is sort of the common thread that ties everything together and holds it. You know, being honest in my music and being honest in my songwriting is just as important as being open and honest with the world about who I am.
You're living in North Carolina, and that state now is dang near ground zero for progressive activism and conservative gerrymandering and bathroom bills and stuff like that. You know, for those of us here in Central Illinois, what is it like on the ground politically in North Carolina right now?
It's a really strange time. I feel like over the course of a very few short years, we've taken several giant strides backwards. And I think that politically, both sides have certainly been really worked up in a sort of emotional fervor. And you've got, you know, one side getting their people all riled up in you know, one way, and the other side's just like, you know, why is this even an issue? You know, mentioning HB2, the bathroom bill, which has since been replaced with a bill that's really not much better. It came under the guise of being an improvement, but it's really not. If you look at the details, it's kind of flabbergasting, honestly. There are literally zero cases of transsexuals, you know, molesting children in bathrooms. Like, that's just not a thing. For this bill to be passed that's so blatantly discriminatory and simply not based in any semblance of reality, it was really shocking when it first came through. There were a lot of immediate grassroots concerts and benefits and all kinds of things that were really good, and it was kind of a positive way to combat some total insanity.
the album from Sarah Shook and the Disarmers. It's powerful. It's deep. It's rock and roll and punk and country and all that. But as tough as the album is lyrically, the album ends. It ends optimistically with "The Road That Leads to You."
Yeah, I thought that ending with that song was the right move, because it does cap off a whole lot of certainly more despondent songs with a little bit of resilience and a little bit of I don't think it's a very long song either. It's kind of a short and sweet little "we've got this" sort of fist bump kind of song, you know.
Sarah Shook, leader of Sarah Shook and the Disarmers, speaking with GLT's John Norton. Shook and the band play the Rose Bowl Tavern in Urbana Sunday night. Thanks for choosing Sound Ideas on WGLT Normal. Our website is where you can download the Sound Ideas podcast or find the individual interviews today from Laura Kennedy, Judy Valente, John Norton, and Charlie Schlenker. The address is WGLT.org. We want to know what you think of Sound Ideas. Share your thoughts at Facebook.com/WGLTFM or tweet, use the hashtag Sound Ideas. I'm at Mike McCurdy. We're all at WGLTFM. This is GLT and WGLT.org, Bloomington Normal's public media.